You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by ProntPops.wordpress.com and KDUXWebRadio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. This is the Monday edition. We learn now that Donald Trump did not order a military strike, although that was an option. They were waiting for the go, and which tells me it most likely was going to be a missile attack, and he decided not to do it. And the reason given was simply that over 100 people, something like 150, upwards of 150 people could be killed if they launched a missile attack. Now, that doesn't surprise me, because if you're going to attack a radar site, missile site, installation, it depends on the target and what's there, but you're going to have military personnel as a minimum there. Now, 150 sounds high, but it could depends where the missile facility is. It could be near civilian or residential areas. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's in the boonies, but it depends on the target. And I think he did the right thing. Now, I'm a non-interventionist. I don't believe in this aggressive intervening in country after country, and then the United States being policeman of the world, simply because, one, it's expensive. Two, it results in American soldiers, sailors, airmen, infantrymen being killed. And I asked myself, when I heard about this drone, why are we flying a drone? I know the answer, but why were we flying a drone right next to the Iranian border? Well, yeah, we're going to gather intelligence, but I assume that they have been doing that for years. Maybe I'm wrong, or they also have satellites. Was it really necessary to fly right next to the border? It's sort of an attempt almost to provoke an attack, and guess what? The drone was shot down. We lost over $100 million. Now, that's a rounding error when you're talking the Pentagon budget. They spent hundreds of billions every year, but it all adds up. So I was not surprised that he didn't call it off, said, no, we're not going to go ahead with it. Now, why? It's not proportional. It's excessive, quite frankly. But see, I have another concern. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, that was a surprise attack. And Franklin Roosevelt went to Congress and asked for a declaration of war. Now, we had over 2,000, I forget the exact number. But prior to 9/11, the highest fatalities in an attack like this, a surprise attack like that, and that was mostly military personnel, but civilian personnel were killed. But primarily Navy and Army, Air Force, Army personnel were killed. And then we did the right thing, and that was the last time we declared war. Under the Constitution, that's what you're supposed to do. We never do it anymore. So neither the Democratic Party nor the Republican Party follows the Constitution. I'm a constitutionalist, and there's a reason you have Congress declaring war, because it's a natural tendency of the executive, whether it's a commander, a chief, a king, whatever, wanting to get involved in military campaigns, adventures abroad. Now, usually, and I understand this, where the United States vessels or aircraft or civilians are attacked, there is a certain amount of urgency, and you don't want to lose the element of surprise in a response. But what I think is far, far more important is to make sure the American people are on board. And I really believe the American people are tired of sending their sons and daughters, and tired tired of billions, hundreds of billions, trillions being spent in the Middle East. Now, you could make a strong case, okay, at one time we needed the oil, because the United States went from being the leading producer of oil to Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, you know, both Iran and Iraq supplying oil. And we have been, whether you like it or not, allies with Saudi Arabia since the Roosevelt administration, and mainly because of the oil. They have a lot of sand and a lot of oil. It's like East Texas, a lot of sand and a lot of oil. But now that we are using more advanced technologies to both explore for oil and natural gas, as well as drill for it, we are now we have the leading reserves. We have more reserves in Saudi Arabia, and we're producing more oil, and we're exporting oil from being a major importer of oil to being an exporter. So the situation has changed as technology has led to more recovery of oil and natural gas and more discovery of large reserves all over the United States, in certain areas primarily, but all over, where, especially in the past, there was oil and natural gas. So the American people are saying, well, why are we there? And that gets the elites disturbed, because the American people are no longer supporting an interventionist policy. They aren't. They don't want a war. They don't want a war with Iran, even though you can make a very, very strong case that they've been killing Americans for 40 years. I understand that. I mean, the temptation is to just annihilate them. The problem is, it's in all of these situations, you have a small oligarch, a small group of people that control the country. They're virtual dictators. They are dictators. Now, this is religious based, but they have the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and they're basically to control not only the people, but other parts of the government. They are corrupt. And so Donald Trump today, and I'll play it, imposed sanctions on them in particular, which is probably a more measured response. Hit them where it really hurts, money, because that's when they start to squeal. You see, ideally what we want to happen is eventually the Iranian people overthrow the existing regime. And that's difficult because all the weapons are controlled, or most of the weapons are controlled, by either the military or the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Now, what is Donald Trump trying to do? And I've said this repeatedly, although listen to the news, got to listen closely. What Donald Trump's number one foreign policy objective is to stop the spread of nuclear weapons to countries such as the Islamic Republic of Iran and North Korea, communist North Korea. That's what he wants to accomplish. And that means bringing pressure on both regimes. Now, the leverage with North Korea is with the Communist Chinese Party has the most leverage on North Korea. And our leverage with the Communist Party, the Chinese Communist Party, together with North Korea, in turn, is what? Trade. We could put a total embargo on Chinese goods today. It'd take less than 15 minutes. But that would disrupt what? Supply chain. Because you have U.S. companies, retailers, that rely on getting a lot of goods from communist China. So when you put an embargo on, they have to find alternative sources. Now, many are going to do that. If they're, let's say, prudent, they will have at least two or three other sources, and they could change their purchases to other countries, including the United States. But our only real leverage, short of war, whether conventional or nuclear, with North Korea is the Chinese Communist Party and its leadership putting pressure on North Korea. Now, why do I emphasize this and keep emphasizing this? The only reason North Korea has nuclear weapons and long-range missiles is because the assistance they've been provided, the technology, the funding, from primarily China, but also Russia. Russia produces a lot of rockets. In terms of the launch vehicles, they're copies of Chinese communist launch vehicles, and some are imported. North Korea is a poor country. Its people are, let's say, undernourished. I'm not saying starving, but they're not. If you go to North Korea, I haven't been, but if you look at pictures, you don't see many obese people. The only obese people are the leader, Chairman Kim. It's a brutal dictatorship. It's a totalitarian regime, and that's another example of a regime that needs to be overthrown. But how do the people do it if they don't have weapons? That's why I'm a strong advocate of the Second Amendment, because as long as we have the Second Amendment, your right to bear and keep arms, it gives pause to our leaders whether to try to take them away. Now, they've done that in Australia and the United Kingdom. And what happens? Crime increases. Home invasions increase. We have a different history. We have valued that right in the Second Amendment and will not let any political party, Democrat, Republican, or any party, take that right away from us. And yes, we have people that I call the gun grabbers that want to do that. They would like to repeal the Second Amendment. And I challenge the Democratic Party. In the past, you've been real big on wanting to repeal the Second Amendment. Why don't you clearly come out for that? Now, I'm sort of baiting them because the American people don't support that. The majority of American people believe in the right to bear and keep arms. It's the ultimate check against an out-of-control government. And we have an out-of-control government, whether you like it or not. Government spending is totally out of control. And as long as we keep electing Democrats and Republicans, you're going to get the same result. So President Trump wants to stop nuclear proliferation, really an arms race, because there are at least, I would say, two dozen countries, developed countries, that are perfectly capable of building nuclear weapons and delivery systems, either aircraft or missiles. They don't do it because they see it, and I think correctly, it's a waste of money. You should and probably never will use them. It's a weapon you never use, and it's expensive to maintain them and safeguard them. But Trump has the right foreign policy objective here. And yes, we want to stop Iran and Korea, North Korea, having nuclear weapons and the missiles that can deliver them. Now, in the Middle East, you can rest assured that if the Israelis have solid intelligence, that the Iranians not only have the missiles that can hit their country, but also have downsized, miniaturized the nuclear weapons. And as far as I'm concerned, they have the nuclear weapons. Their problem is they haven't been able to miniaturize them to the best of our intelligence. But once they do and can marry them or put them on a missile, they need to test it. But they might test it by sending a missile into Israel. So Israel and their Israeli defense forces will take out any, once they have the evidence. Now, any nuclear bomb-making capability, the challenge is that the Iranians wisely have put their research facilities deep in a mountain. Now, yes, we could cut off the entrances into the mountain, but it would take multiple missions to really destroy it, and you probably do need nuclear weapons to do it, because our bunker buster bomb simply could not take it out. And it's a dangerous mission because it's a very long flight, and it would very much have to be a surprise attack by the Israelis. So they could do it once, but it's really not clear at all that one surprise attack can completely destroy the nuclear research, production, testing facilities that Iran has. So if we do go after, Israel goes after these facilities, and probably with the assistance of the United States, because you need tankers to do this, folks. It's a long flight. And yes, they can. Their F-16s, for example, can carry nuclear bombs. So can some of the other aircraft. And they most likely have missiles that can do that as well. But the Israelis have taken out nuclear facilities, mainly producing fuel in Syria and Iraq. So it's not unprecedented. And again, it's up to the intelligence. Once, in my mind, once the United States and or Israel finds out that they have not one, but many nuclear weapons, and they put them on a missile and have tested it, they're going to wipe them out. It's a matter of survival. That truly, in my mind, is what they call an existential threat. And they believe the rhetoric of the leadership coming from Iran. That's what they want to do. They think the 12th Imam is going to come out of a well and lead this attack. Well, that's the problem. When nuclear weapons are in the hands of fanatics, not rational actors, that's dangerous. And I think President Trump is absolutely right in trying to make this his number one objective. The question is, how do you go about it? Do you do it through diplomacy or do you do it through military intervention? And a third choice is sanctions. Right now, President Trump wants sanctions. Let me play a short clip on the nuclear weapons, President Trump.
Their inflation is through the roof. They've never had the highest in the world right now, worse than any place. They're living not well.
Do you want to do a separate deal with Iran, or do you want to get everybody involved in the same deal? Get the Russians, get the Chinese.
I don't care what kind of a deal. It can be separate or it can be total.
But it's one-on-one talks, you and the Ayatollah?
Is it
one-on-one talks, you and the Ayatollah, or you and the president?
It doesn't matter to me. You know, here's what I want. Anything that gets you to the result, they cannot have a nuclear weapon. It's not about the Straits. You know, a lot of people covered it incorrectly. They never mentioned. They cannot have a nuclear weapon. They'd use it, and they're not going to have a nuclear weapon.
See, that's the key point. They will use it. Now, I think they would be mad. That's why I say they're not rational actors. They're religious fanatics. And that's the problem with religious fanatics. Now, you can have political fanatics. The ends justify the means. And we have them in the United States, and we have them abroad. We can't trust nuclear weapons in the hands of this religious regime, or for that matter, North Korea. So that is the number one objective. That is the end game of what President Trump is trying to do. He doesn't particularly want war with Iran or regime change. He just wants to make it very, very clear that we will take necessary steps. Everything's on the table. That's another way to say it. To make sure you never get nuclear weapons. And if you should get close, I think you're going to see a military response both from the United States and Israel, probably Israel first. They have more to lose because they won't have an intercontinental ballistic missile, but they have an intermediate range missile that most likely could hit not only Israel, but parts of Europe. So it's in the European nation's interest as well as Israel's interest to make sure Iran does not get the missile capability and the nuclear capability together so they could hit targets in the Middle East and Europe. Now, one other thing to keep in mind, and it's important, is if other nations such as Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, Turkey, they believe Iran has nuclear weapons, they will have a nuclear arms race or getting close to it. Now, Saudi Arabia has some missiles. They're not very accurate, but you don't have to be accurate if the warhead is a nuclear warhead. And they could get the nuclear warheads from Pakistan. Remember, the Saudis are first and foremost Arabs. That's their ethnic group. Second, they're Islamic, but they're Sunnis. The majority of the people that faith is Islam are Sunni, call it the Sunni sect. The minority sect is the Shia. Now, there's several sects, but those are the two major divisions. Roughly 89-90% of the world, not just in Saudi Arabia, are Sunnis. And there are different schools. I'm not going to take it that far. I could, but I'm not going to do it. So you have fundamental religious differences because the Iranians are, the ethnic group is Persian, and they believe in Shia. They're Shia sect of Islam, and they've always had differences. Now, they can and have gotten along for generations, but they don't really like each other. It's very much like in Europe when the Catholics and Protestants were killing each other. It was that violent, that savage. And that's the same with the Sunni and Shia. Now, we have in the West today religious toleration, thank God, because eventually the Christians, whether you were Protestant, Catholic, or any other sect, and there were many of them, Lutherans, Baptists, Presbyterians, and on and on and on, in terms of the Protestants, and then you have the Catholics, together, for several centuries, they were at each other's throats, but eventually got sick of it. It was, you eventually said, this is, no one's benefiting. Everyone, this is not the way to go. And eventually we have religious tolerance. But it took several hundred years, and many nations, not the United States, would establish a religion, whether it was Catholicism or Lutheranism, Episcopalian in the United States. And initially, the states would have established religions, but we went the route of having religious freedom. So we tolerate each other's religion. And yes, you're going to have frictions, and some people don't like Catholics. Catholics don't like Baptists. The Baptists don't like the Mormons. That still exists. You're not going to change human nature. But the point I'm trying to make is, if the Sunnis, especially Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Turkey, believe that Iran has the long-range missiles and the nuclear capability and has a number of warheads, they're going to do what? They're going to make sure they have the nuclear capability. So Donald Trump is doing more than the right thing. He's doing the smart thing in saying, we're not going to allow Iran and North Korea to have the weapons. Now, the response on the left is, well, who are we to say? Well, we're trying to protect not only the United States, but other our allies and other countries against the number one nation state sponsoring terrorism, especially through proxies. So Donald Trump is really enunciating, articulating a foreign policy that the overwhelming majority of American people agree with, as well as people in the Middle East and the Far East. For example, in the Far East, Japan could develop nuclear weapons fairly quickly. They don't want to do that. South Korea could do it probably better and quicker than North Korea. But then you have an arms race in the Far East. And just to review, the United States and Russia, formerly the Soviet Union, have nuclear weapons and both bombers, primarily missiles, to deliver them, whether they're on submarines or launched from mobile land launchers or underground. And the United Kingdom and France, that makes four. And then we have China and India. And there you have a lot of tensions. Pakistan as well, with India. China with India. And who else? Israel, North Korea. And my opinion, only opinion, is Iran has them, but they haven't tested them, and they're too big. They have to miniaturize them. But they'll do that, and they'll do that in secret. And remember, they're doing this deep inside a mountain, so it's hard to spy on them. You need human intelligence, as well as cyber intelligence, intercepting messages, which our National Security Agency does, to try to find out what is the situation, what are their intentions, and where do they stand in terms of the development of nuclear weapons, and the success or lack of success of missiles. Now, both North Korea and Iran have many, many short-range missiles. What I'm talking about are intermediate-range, think 400, 500 miles, as well as intercontinental ballistic missiles. There you're talking thousands of miles. It's a combination of a delivery system, long-range intermediate missiles, as well as miniaturizing the warheads so you can, it's the weight of the nuclear weapon, so you can put it on a missile. And then you got to test it because they got to work together. And the warhead has to re-enter the atmosphere after the missile is launched. So there are a lot of steps, but North Korea is furthest along. It's estimated they have upwards of somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60 warheads. Now, the question is the size of the warhead, the weight and the size. I commend President Trump in doing anything he can, short of war, to stop the Iranians, as well as the North Koreans, from developing a credible and viable nuclear weapons capability. I think North Korea has it. And that's why Iran is purchasing as much as they can in terms of research from North Korea, because what does North Korea need? It needs energy, and Iran has oil and natural gas. And what is the, if you look at the Far East, Japan, China, they need energy. They need to import oil, natural gas, as well as coal. Remember, to power an industrial, developed industrial nation, you need energy first to power the electrical grid, and that has been traditionally coal, now natural gas, oil at one point, hydro, if you have mountains and streams that you can dam up, and yes, nuclear. And what is Communist China building? Many, many coal-fired as well as nuclear-fired electrical generation plants. So energy is key. And then to fuel your vehicles, whether they be cars, trucks, airplanes, tanks, ships, you need petroleum products, gasoline, diesel. So energy is critical for any developed nation, both in terms of producing goods and services, as well as defending their nation against attack. And people need ways to get around, and gasoline. Look at the United States. We're very dependent on gasoline to power our vehicles, autos, trucks. But remember, most of you are thinking pickup trucks, but trucks are used to transport goods across the country. Both the resources to make the goods, as well as once the goods are made, to ship it to various distribution points and in turn from there to retail stores. So any successful, growing, booming economy needs energy. And again, Trump is right. We need to develop our own energy resources. We're fortunately blessed with abundance of energy, primarily oil and natural gas. You see, the problem with solar power, as well as wind turbines, is they're intermittent. If the sun is shining, yeah, solar panels are great. But if the sun's not out, or you have a very cloudy day, or the wind's not blowing, you need to have backup sources of electrical power. But the real bottleneck is the battery to store the electrical power. That is the real problem. And eventually, who knows, we'll probably discover a way to do that. Now, as long as the sun is shining and you're using the power from your solar panels, or if it's being generated, the wind turbines. For example, in West Texas, I've been out there. Been a while. Oh, a good 10 years. But I made a trip out there. I was on business and passed. It's barren territory. There are very few people out there. There's some. And there are roads, but not that many. And you see these big, giant wind turbines. They're not all over. They have to be in spots where you have a lot of wind. But even if you have a lot of wind and you build the turbines and you connect them with the grid, what happens when the wind's not blowing? You're not producing power. So there are many sources of energy. You need to really take advantage of all of them and try to optimize which is the better one to use. For decades and decades, it was coal. Now, what's the problem with coal? If you burn it, if you don't have the necessary scrubbers, there's a lot of particulate matter. Think of it as soot, but it also has nitrogen and sulfur oxides that are not good for you. So the United States requires investments in technology, equipment that will minimize those. And that's why we have clean air. Other countries that simply don't have the money, communist China, they don't do that. And as a result, yes, carbon dioxide emissions are up. And yes, it can change on the margin, the parts per million. But see, carbon dioxide is a trace gas. That's why it's parts per million. And even when it doubles from 200 to 400 parts per million, and yes, it's probably caused by humans now burning energy sources, whether it's coal, oil, natural gas. Is that the major cause of climate change? There are many causes for climate change. That's the problem with the argument. They say that human activity is the cause of climate change. Now, I agree, climate is changing, and yes, to a certain extent, human activity does put carbon dioxide in the air, but there are a lot of other things going on. There are at least a dozen or more major causes of climate change that have nothing to do with human beings. That's why I don't get excited about the Reds, the radical extreme Democrats that are pushing these green agenda. They frankly don't understand the science, can't really explain it to you, but they try to panic you. And they have done that to the young. They have indoctrinated the young to be scared of climate change. The world's going to end soon. Well, we're all going to die, point number one. And two, the planet can take care of itself. And three, there are many causes of climate change that we can do absolutely nothing about. The sun, its orbit, clouds. We don't control clouds. Precipitation. There are a lot of things that climate is probably one of the most difficult scientific problems because we don't know enough. And the reason why we don't know enough, and you can see it, is these climate models, computer models, are wrong. And when a model gets wrong results, why? We don't really know what's going on. And what they can't really predict very well is precipitation, rain, snow. And that's key. Now, I'm not going to get in on the climate situation other to mention that. The more bigger problem is we don't want any nation or terrorist group to use nuclear weapons against the United States, Europe, or really any country in the world. It's in the interest of the various countries of the world to minimize the spread of nuclear weapons. We already have 9 or 10 countries that have them. We don't want a nuclear arms race. That would be, frankly, a waste of money on the nations that do that. But Saudi Arabia, Japan, and other nations, Turkey, Egypt, could, if they wanted to, develop nuclear weapons. And yes, they could get a head start by buying, for example, the nuclear warheads from Pakistan. Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and they could sell it to Islamic regimes that are close to them. In other words, they're Sunni, so they would sell it to, for example, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey. We don't want an arms race, and we certainly don't want a nuclear arms race, because that would totally destabilize even more the Middle East, the Far East. And you're going to have, if that happens, if we have an arms race, eventually someone is going to either intentionally or unintentionally use it. And then you see the mushroom cloud, whether that's over Tel Aviv, Los Angeles, New York, Washington, or various cities in Europe. We don't want that. So you need to keep the eye on the ball. But the answer is not war after war after war, or intervention after intervention. It's to use a combination of sanctions, negotiations, diplomacy, and military efforts to try to convince regimes such as North Korea and the Islamic Republic of Iran to give up that. Now, why are they so insistent on that? Now, they'll cite a good example as Libya. Libya, initially, people believed it was going for nuclear weapons. It turns out they simply didn't have the capability. They had some of the, let us say, components that you need, but they really never put it together. You need a certain amount of know-how amongst your citizens to do this. But the Pakistanis, Indians, Chinese, Russians all eventually figured it out. It just takes money and time, and it's an engineering problem. And we certainly don't want individuals to build nuclear arms. The reason they don't is because most of them don't have the knowledge. And you need the fuel. That's the key thing, that you need the fuel to have the nuclear explosion. That's the other key ingredient. President Trump is doing the right thing, the responsible thing, into trying to minimize and eliminate two nations from having nuclear weapons, namely North Korea and the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now let's hear a little bit more on President Trump. And this is in the interview with Chuck Todd. I believe it was either Friday or Saturday. Most likely, they taped it on Friday. They broadcast it. I listened to it Sunday.
Did you greenlight something, or had you said, if nothing, we do it, I'll do this? What was the order you gave?
Nothing is green-lighted until the very end, because things change, right?
So you never gave a final order?
No. But we had something ready to go, subject to my approval. And they came in, and they came in about a half an hour before. They said, sir, we're about ready to go. I said, I want a better
planes
definition.
Planes in the air? Were planes
no,
in the
we're
air?
We're about ready to go.
Yeah.
No, but they would have been pretty soon. And things would have happened to a point where you wouldn't turn back or couldn't turn back.
Let me interrupt here, and Todd should know this. We have destroyers. These are not World War II destroyers. They are modern destroyers. That their primary weapon is cruise missiles, and some are nuclear, some aren't. So you fire nuclear weapons, cruise missiles, at a target. We also have a cruiser that has it. We also have submarines that have it. So once the president greenlights it, gives the okay, you have the authorization to launch, not instantaneously, it takes a little time to spread the message, and they launch. Now, in conjunction with that, it depends on the targets. You can launch military aircraft. If they're going after, it depends how many targets. What would they go after? Well, the battery that launched this, that brought down the drone, has a number of missiles, and it's a radar site. That would be probably the number one thing to take out, both the radar and the missile site. You also go after what's called command and control facilities, communications facilities, that are used to give the orders, and you typically go after other radar sites, anything that could bring down our aircraft. Because if you're going to follow up with aircraft attacks after the missile attack, you don't want their missiles bringing down our aircrafts. You have a list, a target list. You have priorities. Certain things obviously want to be taken out first. You want to have, first of all, take out the radars. Then they're blind. Radar is the eyes, and it does assist the missiles in terms of where to go. So you want to take out a battery of missiles, obviously, the command bunkers that launch them, and the radar with them, and any command and control. So it's probably they had a number of targets, 2, 3, 4, who knows. And that would involve a combination of first striking with the cruise missiles. And once the cruise missiles are launched, probably I would say 30 to 60, maybe more. Again, it depends on the targets, how many. And while they're accurate, they don't 100% get bullseyes. And then you come in with aircraft that would destroy not only the radar and the anti-aircraft missiles, batteries, as well as take out their Air Force and Navy facilities. So it depends on what are you trying to accomplish. And it needs to be, in my mind, proportionate. In other words, you don't take out their Army, take out their Air Force, the Navy, because they shot down a drone. You could, and some presidents probably would, but no one was killed. And Donald Trump, President Trump, made it very clear, had a drone had a human being in it. Now, drones are unmanned aircraft. They're controlled remotely. So there was no human in it, but this drone is not your toy drone. This is a large, large, large drone. It's big. It's like an airliner. It's like shooting down an airliner. It's expensive. It's $120 million plus. And yes, you have people, like I said, in the last show, that want war. War is a lot of money for a lot of defense contractors. Now, they'll never say that. It's big business, folks. We have big government, big business, big military. And if you're wondering why we have a deficit heading towards $23 trillion, and by the time Trump leaves, it'll probably upwards of $40 trillion. Big part of that, not all of it, but a big part of that is what? All the interventions the United States has had since World War II. And there have been many of them. Some small, some medium, some large, some extra large. And they all cost money. And when you don't have balanced budget, that means you pay for it by going into debt. Trump has made clear there was no, he didn't give the launch code or green light to go do it. They were asking him for that. And he said no, because the estimate was they would kill upwards of 150 people.
So they came and they said, sir, we're ready to go. We'd like a decision. I said, I want to know something before you go. How many people will be killed? In this case, Iranians. Mm-hmm. I said, how many people are going to be killed? Sir, I'd like to get back to you on that. Great people, these generals. They said, came back, said, sir, approximately 150. And I thought about it for a second. I said, you know what? They shot down an unmanned drone, mm-hmm. plane, whatever you want to call it. And here we are sitting with 150 dead people that would have taken place probably within a half an hour after I said, go ahead.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it. I didn't think it was proportionate.
Now, the American people are accepting this explanation. Not that the president has to explain, but he needs to explain, and did brief Congress. The American people are sick of war in the Middle East. They want to bring the troops home. So does Trump. Why are we interfering in conflicts between groups in the Middle East? We pick sides, and sometimes, a lot of times, quite frankly, you don't want to be their ally, but because of the resources they have, and I'm talking oil and natural gas, we are. And what comes to mind is Saudi Arabia. But before the revolution in Iran, you had the Shah was backed by the United States, and he was an ally. And we sold him, I believe, F-14s, a lot of military equipment. And that's, keep that in mind. One of the things we do is supply the world. Russia does the same thing. But the United States is the world's leading armament producer, and we sell it to countries. Foreign military sales, FMS, foreign military sales. And it's big business. And we do it because it brings down the cost to the United States of its, for example, aircraft, whether it's the F-15, F-16, F-18, F-22. We don't sell the F-22, but the F-35, instead of producing, let's say, 700 or 800 for the United States Air Force, we supply our allies and then countries that want to buy it. And you're looking at thousands of aircraft. It's a way to go down what they call the learning curve. The hours required to produce the aircraft, it's going down a slope. So the more further down that slope, it takes less time to produce the aircraft. And less time means less cost in buying the aircraft. It's business, folks. That's what I've been trying to say. The sale of armaments, whether it's weapon systems, whether it's aircraft, ships, tanks, armored vehicles, or rifles, pistols, missiles, anti-tank, grenades, we produce them for our military and for many of the militaries in the world, in Europe in particular. Now, to some extent, they might produce part of these aircraft, so-called offsets, industrial offsets. In other words, share the production. But with these more sophisticated and weapon systems, I'm thinking the F-35, for example, nations decide we don't want to get involved in it in the, we want to buy it, but we're not going to be in the production of the parts. That's the nation-by-nation decision. Because, for example, in Europe, you have the capability of producing these aircraft. And in Japan, the same thing. But that's not the efficient or most cost-effective way to do it. If you truly want to get the cost down and go down the learning curve, you do it at one facility, whether it's owned by the contractor or the government. So we are the world's major supplier of weapons, but we have competition too from Russia, Communist China, and other nations. It's big business. It's a lot of profit. It's a lot of career opportunities. And many of our military will retire and then go work for one of these defense contractors. Or if they're Congress, they'll go to a lobby organization and lobby Congress. And one way to get Congress, the House of Representatives, as well as the Senate, behind a weapon system is what the weapon systems manufacturers do. They make sure they put, if not in all 50 states, many states, they have some subcontractors making parts, part of the weapon system, whatever it is. Whether it's the engine, the radar, the avionics, the gun, missiles. You spread the business around to get support behind a weapon system, and then guess what? Your representatives, whether Democrats or Republicans, support the weapon system. Now, once you have the weapon system in the field, once you have the capability, you want to use it. And that means war, conflict, and intervention. It's a vicious cycle. Now, I'm for a strong national defense. Don't take me the wrong way. But we've come to a point in our history that the American people say, enough is enough of this. At one time, they could see, for example, defending Israel, as well as our allies in the Middle East. But now, most of these nations have a sizable military, Air Force, Army in particular, not so much Navy, but they do. And their large weapons they get from either the United States or our competitors. For example, Russia, France, for example, United Kingdom. So there's more than one source for weapons, and it's a competitive situation. And yes, you even have bribery. Oh, it's illegal for the U.S. to bribe, but it goes on. So there's a momentum, if you will, to start wars. And when administrations get in trouble, that's exactly what's happened. Then we can go to a war footing, and then the government has more control over you and me. It's a way to centralize power, and that's what happens. And then you quickly lose your freedoms. So you got to be very careful, vigilant, and I think Trump is very much doing the right. President today did impose sanctions. This is from the Oval Office.
In a few moments, I'll be signing an executive order imposing hard-hitting sanctions on the Supreme Leader of Iran and the Office of the Supreme Leader of Iran and many others. Today's action follows a series of aggressive behaviors by the Iranian regime in recent weeks, including shooting down of U.S. drones. You shot down the drone. I guess everyone saw that one. And many other things. They've done many other things aside from the individual drone. You saw the tankers, and we know of other things that were done also, which were not good and not appropriate. The Supreme Leader of Iran is one who ultimately is responsible for the hostile conduct of the regime. He's respected within his country. His office oversees the regime's most brutal instruments, including the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Sanctions imposed through the executive order that I'm about to sign will deny the Supreme Leader and the Supreme Leader's office and those closely affiliated with him and the office access to key financial resources and support. The assets of Ayatollah Khomeini and his office will not be spared from the sanctions. These measures represent a strong and proportionate response to Iran's increasingly provocative actions. We will continue to increase pressure on Tehran until the regime abandons its dangerous activities and aspirations, including the pursuit of nuclear weapons, increased enrichment of uranium, development of ballistic missiles, engagement in and support for terrorism, fueling of foreign conflicts, and belligerent acts directed against the United States and its allies. The agreement that was signed was a disaster. It was not doing what it was supposed to do. Many bad things were taking place. And most importantly, it was so short-term that within a very short number of years, they would be able to make nuclear weapons, and that's unacceptable. Never can Iran have a nuclear weapon. Also included in this is we want the stoppage immediately of their sponsoring of terrorism. They sponsor terrorism at a level that nobody's ever seen before. And that's been over the last number of years. And they've taken all of that money that was given to them by the past administration, and much of it was given out to terrorist organizations. In fact, I remember when John Kerry was asked the question about whether or not this money will be spent for terror, he actually said yes, or at least he was referring to some of it. But he said, yes, it will be used for terror. If you can believe that, we're giving them money. We're saying, yes, it can be used for terror. That was not a good answer. But that was the least of it, frankly. So America is a peace-loving nation. We do not seek conflict with Iran or any other country. I look forward to the day when sanctions can be finally lifted and Iran can become a peaceful, prosperous, and productive nation. That can go very quickly. It can be tomorrow. It can also be in years from now. So I look forward to discussing whatever I have to discuss with anybody that wants to speak. In the meantime, who knows what's going to happen? I can only tell you we cannot ever let Iran have a nuclear weapon, and it won't happen. And secondly, and very importantly, we don't want money going out to sponsor terror. They are the number one sponsor of terror anywhere in the world. So I'll sign this order right now, and I want to thank our military. I want to thank all of the people that have been working with me over the last number of months on this. I think a lot of restraint has been shown by us, a lot of restraint. And that doesn't mean we're going to show it in the future. But I felt that we want to give this a chance, give it a good chance, because I think Iran potentially has a phenomenal future. And I say that about North Korea, too. I've said it about North Korea. I think North Korea has a phenomenal future. And I think Iran also has a phenomenal future. And it would like to, I think a lot of people would like to see them get to work on that great future. So I'll sign this now, and I appreciate you all being here. Thank you.
You signed two copies.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody.
Mr. President, is your goal to negotiate a new deal with Iran? Mr. President, is your goal to negotiate a new deal?
We would love to be able to negotiate a deal if they want to. If they don't want to, that's fine, too. But we would love to be able to, and frankly, they might as well do it soon. But obviously, the people of Iran are great people. You know, I know many of them. I lived in New York, haven't been there very much the last 2.5 years, but I know many Iranians living in New York, and they're fantastic people. I have many friends that are Iranian, and it's very sad what's happening to that country. The deal should have never been done. It wasn't ratified by Congress. It wasn't properly done, as you know, as a treaty. It wasn't properly done. It was incorrectly done. But we'll get it properly done. So we'll see what happens. I hope it's going to be for the good. But the people in Iran are great people. And all of the people I know, so many in New York, these are great people. Okay? Anything else?
Sir, just to be clear, is this the U.S. response to the Iranians shooting down the drone?
You could probably, Steve, add that into it, but basically this is something that was going to happen anyway.
Okay.
If they breach the uranium limits on the 27th, will you take additional action?
I won't say what I'll do, but I don't think they should do it.
What is your message for the Supreme Leader, and do you want to meet with him one-on-one?
My only message is this. He has the potential to have a great country, and quickly, very quickly. And I think they should do that rather than going along this very destructive path. Destructive for everybody. Destructive for everybody. We can't let him have a nuclear weapon. He said he doesn't want nuclear weapons. It's a great thing to say. But a lot of things have been said over the years, and it turns out to be not so. But he said very openly and plainly for everyone to hear that he does not want to have nuclear weapons. So if that's the case, we can do something very quickly.
That's very, very important if he's telling the truth. Now, I'm not questioning his veracity. And the reason I say it's important, if both parties can agree with the goal of the negotiation, eliminating Iran having nuclear weapons, in other words, they will not pursue the development, production, testing of these weapons, then there's definitely an opportunity to come to mutually acceptable terms and conditions. But the key thing is, has to be enforceable. That was the problem with Obama's agreement, if you will. You didn't have spot inspections because people cheat. Students cheat. Regimes cheat. And it has to be enforceable, and you have to have surprise inspections to make sure either party is not cheating. Now, here, it's the United States has nuclear weapons, but it's only used it once to end World War II. And the reason President Truman ordered their use was if we had invaded Japan, it was going to lead to the deaths of several hundred thousand American soldiers, sailors, airmen, as well as many, many more Japanese military as well as civilians. Now, we were asking for unconditional surrender, and it would have been brutal. The only thing that led to unconditional surrender is the fact that we did not only once, but twice, use nuclear weapons to destroy two cities. And at that point, they surrendered. And we had the famous surrender ceremony on the Missouri. You can go online and there's pictures of it. That ended World War II. What we're trying to do here is to end the spread of nuclear weapons to other nations. And it's very tempting for certain nations, now obviously not small, undeveloped nations, don't have the money or resources to do it. But Iran has a population of about 80 million people. It has a lot of energy resources. Their wealth is their resources in the country, oil and natural gas. So it has the money, if it wants to spend their money, on developing both the missile technology, which governments, nations will do no matter what, to deliver conventional weapons. But if you combine that with nuclear weapons, it makes it many orders of magnitude deadly and dangerous. And then when you add the religious aspects to this, and they hate Israel, and not as much, but the same situation as the Sunnis of Saudi Arabia. From the Israelis' perspective, the Saudi perspective, it would be intolerable for Iran to have nuclear weapons. And yes, Israel has nuclear weapons, probably several hundred. Both bombs that can be delivered by aircraft as well as nuclear warheads on missiles. But they've never used them. Keep that in mind. I agree with President Trump and his efforts. Sanctions may or may not work. The problem with sanctions, it takes a lot of time. It definitely puts a lot of pressure on them. But as long as you have other nations that will cheat or not go along with the sanctions. For example, Russia's right on the northern border with Iran. So I don't think Russia's not going to go along with this. And most likely the Chinese communists are not going to go along with this, and the North Koreans, because what does Iran have to trade for the technology, the weapons, and the warheads? They have oil and natural gas. So North Korea needs them, so does communist China. We didn't launch an attack. Now, let me say this. If one or more military personnel are killed, I think you're going to see, and I really think President Trump at this point needs to act, is going to launch an attack. Most likely what I call one and done. He'll launch a missile attack, maybe missile and aircraft attack. One time, maybe over a 24-hour period, then stop. And then the question is, what will the Iranian regime do? If they respond in kind, then you have an escalating situation and you will have a war in the Middle East. And we do have allies. Saudi Arabia, Israel could very well get involved. So the good news is we did not launch a retaliatory military attack. We're handling this by sanctions and obviously some diplomacy. That's the good news. Also in the news, the Gallup came out with a poll on the Americans' opinion on immigration. And I read the poll, but in retrospect, and this is a problem, especially with Gallup but other pollsters, I always divide Americans' opinion on immigration in two parts. One part is legal immigration. And quite frankly, that's what the poll was covering. If you read it, they make no distinction whatsoever between people that come to the country legally and the American people generally support. I support legal immigration. The only argument is how many. Since the early 1990s, it's been over a million, right around a million, a little million one now, of legal immigrants come to the United States, and they get a permanent legal residence card document, also called a green card. That's if you come here illegally. And eventually you will get citizenship after you meet certain requirements, pass certain tests, and then you become a citizen of the United States. But that enables you, once you come here, to work. And most of the people that come here legally do work. Now, occasionally they might need welfare, but usually they're working. The American people, for decades, I would say its entire history, I would say the American people supported legal immigration. And one time we did more or less have open borders. There were restrictions, though. You couldn't be sick, for example. And you couldn't be a known terrorist or anarchist, troublemaker. But the American people, after poll, and this is just another one, do support legal immigration. But what this poll points out, they asked the American people, what do you consider to be the most important problem today? Now, most people, and this does not surprise me either, if you ask most people what is the largest problem facing the United States today, they'll say government. Some will be a little more specific and say out-of-control government spending. The government is the problem, and that's what the poll says. But then what was second? It was immigration. But they don't make a distinction, and that's the problem with the poll. You don't know, are they talking about legal immigration or are they talking about illegal? Most people, if you ask them what's the problem and what needs to be stopped, and I'm not trying to lead, I'm just trying to say, well, okay, you say immigration is the problem, or are you talking legal immigration? You need a follow-up question, and usually you don't ask it. The American people, there have been many, many polls over the last 33 years, and the American people want to stop what I call the illegal alien invasion of the United States. Note, I didn't say illegal immigrants. If you're an immigrant to this country, you're legal. That's the point. You need to be precise and correct in the languages and words you use, and you have politicians that are trying to confuse you by blurring them, by combining them. Because the American people have made it clear now, year in, year out, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, what they want stopped is the illegal alien invasion of this country. And it's not just stopping it, it's rolling back. In other words, removing and deporting all the illegal aliens that are here. That's why I get a little bit annoyed when I read this poll. And Gallup knows better. It can ask better questions. But the key point here was that 23% of the people polled said the most important problem facing the country today is immigration. If you define that better, I would say the overwhelming majority, I would say 90%, would say it's not legal immigration. You see, here's the problem in a nutshell. I'm for legal immigration. But I don't believe that the United States needs a million people every year. We don't have a labor shortage, folks. We have anywhere from 20 to 30 million Americans that could and would work if they could find a good full-time job with benefits. They're out there, folks. Many of them with a lot of experience, many others that are young. We don't have a shortage of laborers, American citizens that could do the jobs that need to be done. What we have, though, is employers that want inexpensive, cheap, compliant labor. And even though it's illegal to hire illegal aliens, in other words, if you don't have a legal status to work here, if you come here legally, you have that green card, that you're a permanent legal resident. You can work here. You're not a citizen, but you can work here. That's okay. But that's a million a year, 1.1 million, if you want to be a little bit more precise. And that's been the situation since the early 90s. There's nothing new here. Now, I support legal immigration, but I think the number's too high. I think it should be somewhere between 250,000 to 500,000. This is my opinion. There are some Americans that believe the numbers should be zero. Others think it should be 250,000. That's it. Others, and there are others, employers in particular, want a higher number. They don't think a million is enough. They want 2 million, 3 million. Well, the majority of American people don't support that. The people that benefit from cheap, compliant labor, oh yeah, they would like all the illegal aliens that are currently here to have citizenship. And that is the position of the Democrats. Democratic Party. They want to give citizenship to all the illegals, aliens that are here. And you need to understand that. And that's why people are leaving primarily the Democratic Party, but also the Republican Party, because they feel they've been betrayed by both political parties. They favor limited, controlled legal immigration, whatever number they support, and it ranges from 0 up to 3 million a year. But the overwhelming majority of American people, it's 1 million or less. And that's the key point. Now, what they don't want at all are any illegal aliens getting citizenship or getting jobs here. And over a 33-year period, you have anywhere from 30 to 60 million illegal aliens that are here. Now, about a third of them that come into the country leave. And some will go back and forth. They laugh at us. And now we have the problem currently that's new is you have parents, mom or dad, coming with children claiming that they are fleeing persecution and want asylum here. Even though the main reason that the overwhelming majority are coming is economic reasons. And that's why they go right up to the U.S. Border Patrol. And when the Border Patrol asks the question, one of the questions, and they always check it, is they have credible fear from wherever they're coming, from either gangs, the police, the government. So that's why they're leaving. If they come back to a hearing, you find out, no, the real reason they're here is to find a better job, improve their standard of living. You see, in the past, the overwhelming majority of people coming illegally into the country were primarily coming from Mexico, about 80% in Central America, some from the Caribbean, some from South America. They were coming from around the world, and if they were coming here illegally, they would cross in primarily through the U.S.-Mexican border, and that's over half of them. But a large number, a third to 40%, were coming here initially legally, on a passport and or visa. And then what they would do, the visa has a period of time, they would overstay their visa because they like it here and continue living and working here. So because this has gone on for 33 years, we have never really secured the border. The problem is it fluctuates depending on how the economy is doing. When the economy is doing very well and unemployment is low, you typically have more people coming in. Now, when the economy, U.S. economy I'm talking about, goes into a recession, the numbers tend to go down. So it does fluctuate. It does fluctuate. And you can get information on the apprehensions. What is excluded from those numbers? Those are only the ones they catch. In the past, and really continuing today, we don't catch, the U.S. Border Patrol doesn't catch everyone. They're lucky if they get 20%. Because if you ask them, they'll say, well, minimum of 2 or 3 get away. They scatter. When the U.S. Border Patrol pulls up, in the past, what they would do was scatter. Today, some will scatter, but some will immediately go up to the U.S. Border Patrol agent, and I want asylum. That's what they're saying when they know technically they're not really eligible for it. So I wish they would. Gallup needs to be a little bit more precise here. Now, these are interesting numbers, and the key finding was 23% name the number one most important problem. The number one, the most important problem is immigration. That's a lot, because the government is one at 26%. 26% of Americans name the government as the most important problem. So it's still ahead of immigration. That doesn't surprise me. But the trend is upwards, considerably upwards. Because what's happening? Because this is going on and the federal government is in charge of enforcing immigration law, both at the border through the U.S. Border Patrol and in the United States with ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement. That is the problem, that we don't have enough resources there. And because people have eluded being caught, once they get to a city like Dallas, for example, Houston, Austin, and Texas, but California the same way, they find a job. Now, you need documents. What do? They purchase fraudulent documents. And yes, the employers will make copies of it, put it in the folder, but they don't really check. So we have anywhere from 20 to 30, maybe as high as 40 million illegals working here. And they are taking jobs from American citizens. They have done that in the past, and they will continue to do it as long as we do not secure our borders with a border barrier, a continuous border barrier We must enforce the law not only at the borders, but in the United States. And we simply don't have the resources because we're overwhelmed by the sheer numbers. And what Trump was supposed to do, he's delayed it for apparently 2 weeks. He announced at his rally in Orlando that actually was announced a week before, that he was going to go after at least 1 million of those that have already been processed. In other words, they got deportation orders on them, and it was going to be the entire family, because many of these people have kids. They didn't have kids coming. They have kids now, and we need to deport all of them. So it was delayed. It shouldn't have been delayed. It should have, first of all, in my mind, this was a mistake in the sense that it shouldn't have been announced. It should have been done. Now, for public relations, you can make the case that they need to announce it so everybody knows what's going on. The problem is, let's say there are just 30 million illegal aliens here. How long do you think that's going to take any administration? It took 33 years to get the 30 million. It could be 60, but let's say it's just 30. At 1 million a year, that's 30 years. At 3 million a year, that's 10 years. You see the problem? We're deporting, at most, in the peak years, a little over 1 million. Trump has not kept his promise, because he promised to deport all the illegal aliens that are here, and he's not kept his promise. That's why he's finally woke up to the fact that he has a problem. A lot of people that voted for him expected him to shut down the border, build the wall, and deport all the illegals. He hasn't done it. At most, he'll have 400 miles, those are his words, by the end of next year, and he's certainly not going to have 2 or 3 million by 2020. He hasn't kept his promise. And this was the reason a lot of people voted for him and he's president. So Donald Trump has a political problem with his own base. He hasn't delivered on his number one priority, number one promise. Thank you for listening. And now, America the Beautiful.
My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. With a voice of Richland College.
You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio. WordPress.com